Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. You are listening to New Books in Religion, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jackson Reinhardt, and today I am pleased to talk about a new book published by Westminster John Knox Press 2021, The Story of Religion in America, an Introduction, written by James P. Byrd and James Hudnut Boimler. I am pleased to be with them today to talk about this wonderful new book, which presents a broad scope of the story of religion in the American colonies and the United States. This text, while focusing on certain central narratives, including the long shadow of Puritanism and the competition between revival and reason, the defining role of racial and ethnic diversity, this book tells the story of American religion in all its historical and moral complexity. To appeal to its broad range of readers, this text includes charts, timelines, suggestions for primary source documentation that will lead readers into deeper engagement with material. Unlike similar history books, the story of religion in America plays careful attention to the balancing of the story of Christianity with the central contributions of other religions. So James and Jim, thank you so much for appearing on the podcast to talk about this new book.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Great. So first question is just a bit about you both and your educational background. So James, first, can you tell me where you're coming from academically?
Yeah. First of all, it's great to be here. I come from North Carolina, and I was educated at Duke Divinity School for my Master of Divinity. Then I came to Vanderbilt for my PhD, and there studied with various scholars in American religion.
Great. Jim?
And I actually went to Union Theological Seminary for my Master's of Divinity because they had the most church historians. I really knew what I wanted to do, and I was fortunate enough to work with Robert Handy and James Melville Washington as Americanists, and continue that down at Princeton University with John Wilson and Al Rabiteau.
Fantastic. Thank you. I should have also mentioned at the beginning that both James Byrd and Jim Hudnut Boimler are professors at Vanderbilt Divinity School and also Vanderbilt University. So you are both colleagues. You both have background in religious history, but you both have different focuses in this history. James, I'll start with you first. Why did you both decide to write this book, and how did you go about writing it?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of reasons. I mean, one was we were teaching a course called Global Christianities 2, which covers a good bit of American history in it. And in teaching that over the years, and before that, we taught another course in American religious history. And especially in co-teaching, we recognized that there really wasn't a text that we felt was sufficient. So we thought, why don't we just write one? And we worked off of various sources, primary sources and secondary studies. And we recognized that that we could really fit in this field, in this space, and contribute something. And one of the things that this book does is that it is a narrative, and in a narrative form, it takes history seriously. We have recognized some wonderful histories of religion in America that focus more specifically on religious traditions and themes, but don't always focus on the history. So we wanted to present something that took the historical context very seriously in a narrative format. And it just so happened that our different focuses complemented one another. Jim does a lot of work with later stuff, post-Civil War. I do a lot of work with up to the Civil War and have published on the Civil War and before that. So we complemented each other really well in our teaching and our writing, and we enjoyed the process very much.
Fantastic. So, Jim, there are many new books, it seems, every year on histories of American religion. In fact, just I believe a year or two ago, Thomas Kidd, one of the preeminent evangelical historians in America, wrote a book on American religious history. What is the intended audience for this book, both scholarly and with regards to faith, confession, et cetera?
Well, when Westminster John Knox came to us, they said, we have studied all the college courses, the colleges and universities that we sell books to. And there's New Testament, there's world religions, there's religion in America, there's Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, and I think there was one, Christian ethics. And we have a good-selling book in every lane except American religious history. And so they asked us to pitch towards undergraduate college readers. And one of the things that we did that informed the narrative structure was to tell history in a parallel line to students who had probably taken it in like AP US history in high school. So how do we tell the story of religion in relation to the political history, the race, ethnicity, economics, all the kinds of geographical developments that happen, you know, the opening of the West and what have you, and pay greater attention in this volume to indigenous people to the Atlantic world, and let it unfold in terms of the contemporary interests that most of the good narrative short books that are looking at one focus have taken in recent years. The existing textbook market has a lot of books that began in the 1950s in what we might call consensus history. And some of the ones in the 80s began to look at groups, but it was like a European bus tour. If it's Thursday, it must be Croatia. If it's Wednesday, it must be Lutherans. And so what we tried to do was to bring it together with the sort of history that you sort of learned in high school and the religious history that nobody taught you in high school, particularly in American public high schools.
Mm-hmm. So we are at a, I think, critical juncture in American history where religion is on a noticeable decline in participation, in even in rhetoric and discourse and affiliation. So I'll start with you, James, first, and then Jim, because I know you study this particularly. Why is religion important to America? Like, why is there a need for a whole textbook just on religion, which fewer and fewer people seem to find relevant to their everyday lives today?
That's a good question. I think there are a couple of reasons for it. One is religion is still so much a part of the past structure of the nation. So, for instance, recent Supreme Court decisions have reflected religion specifically and religious contexts in those decisions. There are articles out that talk about how religion is so important to some of those conversations, and perhaps inappropriately so. be that as it may, the nation has been structured in large part through religious leaders, and religious ideas have had a prominent place. I mean, civil religion itself, however we define it, has been consistently prominent and important and formative in the way we think about public life, not just public religion, but public life itself. We only have to look at ceremonies to like presidential inaugurals to look at to see things like that and evidence of that. So for one thing, then, religion has been important to the past, to the structure of the nation itself. And when we look at our present, you know, we obviously have to consider our past and how we got there. The other side of it is, while religion is not as prominent as it once was, that doesn't mean that people have no longer a concern for the sacred, or no longer a concern for the meaning of life, the meaning of existence, religious questions, questions of ultimate concern, to quote Paul Tillich from another generation there. So we're still thinking about ultimate issues and doing so in the context of our everyday lives. So I think part of what we try to do in this book is not say just talk about the religious ideas, although they're important, but to talk about them in context. You know, to say, yeah, evangelicalism grew, but it didn't just grow in a vacuum, in a test tube. It grew in response to everyday social, economic, political, cultural issues and pressing dilemmas that people were facing. And those helped to shape what was happening in the religious space.
Jim?
Sure. One of the things, as you know, that I've worked on in the past is the future of the mainline Protestant tradition that was more than half of every adult in America in 1958 belonged to one of just seven old line denominations, with the Methodists and Disciples of the early 19th century representing the most recent groups. Everybody else came from Europe or the British Isles. And that was our sort of culture, the 900-pound gorilla. We're not there anymore. What I find interesting and would add to what my colleague has said is that people continue to have strong ideas in America about where we go when we die, the purpose of life, what an ethical life consists of. And that leads us with what an ethical life consists of to the heart of sort of contemporary problematics in the religious cultural interface, where younger generations don't want to have successively. The younger you are, the less likely it is you'll be in a church on Sunday. But some of the reasons that people younger people don't want to be in a church has to do with a sense of maybe these places are hypocritical, and I'm going to channel my energies into something that's very much like what an old style church would have done in terms of the politics of inclusion. Used to be that your church told you to love everybody and all your neighbors. Now we have alternatives to that, and we will just have to see where all that settles out. We're historians. We tell the story looking towards the past, but I took the last chapter, and so I'm eager to see how it unfolds, and I suspect we haven't seen the last of American religion yet.
Thank you. So one of the core, it seems, conflicts or dialectics in American religious history, which I mentioned in the beginning prologue, is between revival and reason. We could also may talk about this in another way. Those who are committed to doctrine and those who are more committed to a popular, bottom-up, scripture-based religiosity. So again, starting with you, James, and then Jim first, where does this distinction between book learning and kind of this revival tradition come from? And then to you, Jim, how does that continue over the past 150 years to present day?
You know, some of these different ideas about reason and revelation, revival and doctrine have been perennial issues. I mean, they've been issues in the history of Christianity throughout. And these tensions have just, you know, been put into a different context in the United States. One of the remarkable transitions that we note happened during the Enlightenment period, the 18th century specifically, you know, the 1700s, when people thought that they were in an enlightened era, and they felt like that they were getting past some of the nearsightedness of the past and some of the over dogmatism of the past. But one of the interesting things about that is that the Enlightenment developed at the same time as evangelicalism. So revival piety and Enlightenment rationalism played off each other quite nicely, because both sides of that, they seemed to be opposites, but both sides had a lot of things in common. I mean, for one thing, experience, you know, human experience. Both of them took experience and how we know very seriously. How do we know that we really have an authentic religious experience? You know, how do we know about our universe? These questions tied together really well. So that's just one of those ways in which, when we see things in history that seem to be opposites, if you look at them from a broader perspective, look at the cultural issues going on, the social issues going on, as well as the intellectual issues, we see that they have a lot in common quite incisively and sometimes in formative ways, you know, so they shape what's going to happen later. And I think that's what happens. I mean, it's no accident that evangelicalism became so prominent in the United States as compared to many other nations, because it tied together quite well with Republican political ideology and with Enlightenment rationalism in some specific ways. And that's just one example of that tension that seems to have produced, in effect, more and more religious thought and more religious movements even.
Yeah. Jim?
I think I'd add to that that the in the last 150 years, we've seen that play out in some different ways. There are these high moments of theology. You think of Reinhold Niebuhr, John Courtney Murray, and Paul Tillich in the 1950s, and people, you know, learned people and people with no more than a high school education reading their books. We're not in that moment now, but we might be again. There are these times of great interest in a well-versed but accessible version of sort of high religious ideas that make sense once again of scripture and history and tradition. The other story, though, is pragmatism. You know, a way to make a sense of a less theorized, more practiced and more experienced, to use Professor Bird's terms, sense of religion and life. So getting involved in the early 19th century in one of the benevolent societies, in the late 19th century in the social gospel, in the 20th century in the civil rights movement. Civil rights movement didn't ask, you know, are you premillennial or postmillennial? It's like, are you for the, do you believe that God made all men, as they would have said, free? And so we see those kinds of movements, and I think the pragmatic experiential is not only the thing that unites the high tradition and the lower tradition of reason and piety, but it also is its own thing. and continues to be.
To build off that, you speak of the civil rights movement in this pragmatic sense. Obviously, the greatest piece of literature produced in that time was The Letter from a Birmingham Jail by Martin Luther King Jr., which if you read is full, even though he didn't have the books with him, full of citation to theologians, right, and to philosophers. Has there been a even more, especially maybe after the religious right, as the decline of religious participation, even more of a aversion to theology, more embracement of pragmaticism? I just couldn't imagine a major public figure, even if he was a minister, to write something as erudite as A Letter from a Birmingham Jail.
Yeah, so two things are at work, if I may. One is King did a really good job of synthesizing what he read and showing how Augustine tells us an unjust law is no law at all. And in the first instance, he's speaking to other well-educated or seminary-educated white moderates. But to your point, everybody else was able to listen in because they bought these books or they had to study them in college or one of their church groups. It's hard to imagine, that happening today because we tend to read in ruts. There was in the 1950s, maybe for the last time, or in the early 60s, a common culture where people had to say what they thought of Fulton Sheen and Reinhold Niebuhr, and maybe even Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton. Those sorts of common figures we don't have as much. Maybe in literature, maybe Margaret Atwood gets us close.
I was thinking of Rick Warren.
Yeah, Rick Warren's also a synthesizer. One of the things I like about, I find interesting about, his great book, Purpose Driven Life?
Yes.
He quotes like 23 different versions of the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, that was back in the three channel days, right? So there was much more of a shared culture and entertainment culture as well as that. I mean, some of these religious figures were popular cultural figures. Reinhold Niebuhr was on the cover of Time magazine.
So, as was Paul Tillich. I couldn't imagine Paul Tillich being on a cover of any magazine today. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just thinking about it that way. I mean, and just Billy Graham. Think about Billy Graham's reach. So, yeah, it was just a different time, different set of circumstances, and different communication and technology apparatus around it.
And to underline that for a moment, we were a deeply segregated country that nevertheless read the same books and could have a conversation. And now we're a more diverse and in many ways more accepting country, but we don't have the same foundation to draw upon to have a conversation.
Thank you. Things change. One of the many of the figures that we've just mentioned in this past conversation have been Protestant: Martin Luther King, Billy Graham, Paul Tillich. The largest single denomination in the United States has been, for the past, I believe, 100 years, over Roman Catholicism. And one fact that I always find very interesting is that there have been more Unitarian presidents than Roman Catholic, 3-2. So James, I'll start with you first, and then Jim. Why has Roman Catholicism proven to be such a polarizing religion, especially a religion that suffered deep nativist prejudice in the leading up to the American Civil War?
Well, that's because anti-Catholicism was early on so prominent in American history. I mean, reaching back to the Reformation, when the Protestants separated out from the Western Catholic Church, anti-Catholicism started, and then it built up steam, of course, in England. I mean, with Henry VIII separating from the Pope for reasons that we all know, and then casting along in different ways along Calvinist directions with the Anglican Church and and prominently in the Puritans as they came here. And a lot of English people who came here brought anti-Catholicism with them. So anti-Catholicism was considered the gospel. This was the case in the Revolution. This was the case all through the 19th century. So there was this strong strain of anti-Catholic rhetoric, even in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect. I mean, you would find people who were progressive in other ways, in progressive in some social issues, progressive theologically, yet still had that strain of anti-Catholicism. So that was just a part of the cultural DNA, a religious DNA that came along with this mainline Protestant push. And it was just difficult to overcome. And we all know that, you know, with President Kennedy, it was a big issue running for president. So not so much anymore, as we know, but that just is part of that, the past circumstances.
Was there hope amongst the founders, maybe not hope, but desire to ban Roman Catholics from political participation?
I can't think of a founder who was for banning Catholic participation. I just ran across a fact last week that New Hampshire, until 1877, though, barred any but Protestants from holding public office, and Unitarians were considered Protestant for their purposes.
Yeah.
Has been this distrust, and what broke that logjam as much as anything was the contribution of a Jesuit, John Courtney Murray, to the Vatican II documents on the relationships between church and state, because the European Catholicism had bad experiences ever since the French Revolution with secularism and there being a non-unitary state, either Balkanized, as in Great Britain and in America, or in the case of France and later Mexico, an anti-clerical state where Catholics really weren't welcome. It took some doing, and it was Murray who was able to convince the people at the Second Vatican Council that the church could thrive under a diverse social regimen, political regimen, where no church was favored and no church was discriminated against. And that's the settlement of Vatican II, which makes it possible, along with JFK's Houston ministerial speech, for Catholics to really rise to the position where they have a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court seats. An really interesting turn of affairs that might be more significant as a place counter than just the number of presidents who've been Catholic.
I that's completely true. I'm reminded of a quote by, of all people, Pat Buchanan, who said that, this was 10 years ago, who said that it's ridiculous that a country with a majority Protestant at that time has no Protestants on the Supreme Court. At that time, it was all Jews and Catholics. So these two marginalized religious groups had come extraordinarily far within the political system.
But they'd also come to be trusted on issues, moral and legal, under this umbrella of we'll be diverse and we won't favor ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So, James, another part of this book that is this, that you both emphasize is race and ethnic diversity. Obviously, the original sin in the United States was the continuation of slavery until the Civil War. How did the existence of slavery inform religion, especially in those first generations of the United States?
Right. I mean, and this is one thing we wanted to bring out clearly, because slavery has been such a formative influence and part of United States history. really at the center of United States history, along with other important factors. Slavery was a critical dilemma during the Revolution. It was something that the founders wrestled with, although they tried not to do it publicly. It was the source of hypocrisy, of course, as we've understood, with slaveholding founders throughout who constructed a nation that would make its peace with slavery, that eventuated into the Civil War and then Reconstruction after that. So, of course, it would have to have religious influences there and in religious importance. So, part of that has to do with missions. There was great controversy over to what extent enslaved people could be evangelized, and different religious traditions had different perspectives on that. Region, of course, is important with that. Here, I think we have to look at evangelicalism. Professor Albert Rabiteau, in his incredibly important text, Slave Religion, examines how evangelicalism did something that other religious traditions could not do, and that was effectively evangelize enslaved people, showing how that happened and why it happened. So the majority of enslaved people and then free African Americans by the mid 19th century who were Christians were either Baptist or Methodist. So it affected the growth of evangelicalism. It affected the character of evangelicalism in doing that, and also brought the dilemma of slavery to a point that it had not, that probably wouldn't have gotten to if not for the religious influences. I've got to remember that, you know, about a decade before the Civil War, a little over 1844 or 45, both the Methodists and the Baptists split denominationally along regional lines over slavery. And that happened because of the pressure of the issue and because of so many religious people on both sides of the issue.
Also Presbyterians as well, who split.
It's a little more complicated in the Presbyterian side, but still slavery very much a part of that split too.
James, what are some indications of pre-Civil War antebellum Black religion that still exists today?
Yeah, so lots. I mean, thinking about, for instance, even denominationally, the AME Church, one of the more important people that we don't necessarily hear about in religious history or even just overall American history is Richard Allen. And we tried to bring up the importance of Richard Allen, because it's interesting. Some of the people who were just huge in the 19th century, just everybody knew about. Today, not everybody knows about. And one of those people, of course, was Richard Allen. Richard Allen's influence was incredible as not only a denomination builder, but overall as an advocate for social justice in the religious realm and as an evangelical. I mean, he clearly talks about Methodism and why Methodism was the right faith for him, and the power of Methodism. Our colleague Dennis Dickerson, who's in the history department, who's written a really fine book on, to plug that, on the history of the AME, says that Richard Allen was the quintessential Wesleyan. So Richard Allen, just building that denomination, that's just one of many examples of how structures were created that then had much influence. So, you know, the AME Church then just, and that's just one example, had a profound influence on the long civil rights movement. So, yeah, just lots of ways.
Thank you. Jim, you mentioned especially in the chapter on Reconstruction, how important Black benevolent and religious societies were in the face of increasing segregation and violence. What are some examples in which these religions, not only what are examples of these religious and benevolent structures, but how do they help Blacks fight against, you know, as you say, there was at one point a nadir in black life in the United States.
Yeah. And the nadir came after Reconstruction. I think we follow the line in the narrative set by W.E.B. Du Bois that Reconstruction actually was working, and then it was the rug ripped out, or the from the foothold of freed people. The fascinating thing, though, is that the church, having the AME church moving back into the South from where it had largely gone to the North because of inability to assemble, they were there right away after the Civil War, even during the Civil War, and they were founding churches and teaching people to read. And there were some white missionaries who were part of the first generation, but very soon, in the first dozen years or so, most of the 2,000 schools that are founded by Methodists and Baptists are Black-led schools. And so the church became an antidote to that problem that Christian evangelicals and other Christians might love their neighbors, but not think that they're equals. And in the separate churches that became separate, both out of exclusion and out of a desire for dignity, you got within less than 30 years going from less than 1 in 10 people being able to read to over 90% of the Black population able to read. It's an amazing story of what used to be called race uplift. And I think it's a good term because it's exactly what Black people did for themselves under the auspices of the church. Why the church? Well, you didn't have to get elected by the general population. You didn't have to get selected. In the church, you are somebody just because you're in your church. And Black ministers also had a public role that they could exercise right up through the civil rights movement. You see ministers in the vanguard. Why? Who's paying their salary? There's no white boss or power structure that can tell them not to do what they believe themselves to be called to do and their community supports them to do. So that's an important part of the story. We wanted to put more forward and not just treat it like in the civil rights movement, but it's a continuous drumbeat, if you will, throughout this particular book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Is this desire for freedom, for a desire to not be ordered around by a white boss or a white denominational leader, the reason why Blacks have primarily, even though you mentioned, James, about, yes, there was that original evangelical push, but it seems that the major Black denominations in this country, with the exception of the Methodist ones, are Baptist and Pentecostal, congregationalist polities, right? Has this desire for freedom in one's own participation of worship the reason Blacks have more gravitated towards congregational polities?
Perhaps so. I mean, the congregational polity and its jealousy and protection of local church autonomy has certainly had an influence. There's no question about that for sure. And of course, in many cases, the the church community was the only community in which African Americans could have a say and have a voice like whites were able to have in other communities. So that certainly has something to do with it in the South, specifically in the ways in which the different Baptist churches were able to come up, starting out with the invisible institution and then moving out more in the public sphere. So for sure, that's the case. I mean, there are a lot of contributions to that. I mean, even though they're Baptists and their local church autonomy churches, they share a lot with the Methodists. I mean, and Methodists are just, you know, they're just a strange kind of hybrid, because Methodists, although they're hierarchical, they also had a very strong democratic thrust in their religious ethos and in the ways in which they voted and all of that. So they had a lot in common with the local church autonomy, the Baptists, and then later Pentecostal. And of course, Pentecostalism eventuates out of Methodism. I mean, Methodism kind of gets the holiness movement rolling, and then it moves on into Pentecostalism. So that's one of the things I think we're able to bring out in the book by focusing on the historical narrative, by not like having such firm boundaries around talking about, well, we're talking about the Baptists now, we're talking about the Methodists now, we're talking about Pentecostals now. We're able to kind of weave it all in to the historical narrative and show how these boundaries were more porous than normally we might think.
So we've been talking a lot about Christians, and I won't embrace the prejudice. I'll say, yeah, Catholics as well, Protestants and Catholics. Yet America has always been home to a variety of new religious movements, movements that not only break the bounds of Orthodox Christianity, but even go beyond Christianity. So I'll start with you, James, first. Before 1865, what were some of the major non-Christian or heterodox Christian religions that were popping up in the United States?
Well, we have to talk about the Latter-day Saints. The Latter-day Saints, just an amazingly interesting religious movement. They kind of came out of that burned over district, that burned over area that had been so saturated with evangelical preaching and revivalism, and a lot of different new religious movements were emerging out of that context for various reasons. They also caught the wave of the new nation, the westward movement that the white Americans were on, and they brought together so many different diverse religious components from other traditions. The Latter-day Saints, it's just an amazing synthesis that came around through Joseph Smith and the Latter-day Saints as they grew. They seemed to answer all of the questions that so many religions had. One of the issues being denominational competition. They were claiming that they were basically the successors of Christianity, and they were the true Christians, and all other rivals were not up to par. So they're one for sure. There were a lot of others that just did not gather the numbers that the Latter-day Saints did. And it's really just a phenomenal story of why some groups gathered more numbers than others did. One of the things we try to do is to bring out some of those different movements and how they fit into the larger story. And you're always in a dilemma of trying to figure out, okay, how much time do we give to each religious movement? Because you can't give equal time to every single movement. And you have to make hard decisions about which movements you're going to cover and how and why and where. And I think we try to do that again through this historical narrative flow and bring them all together in that.
Jim, before you answer, I want to ask you one thing, James. Latter-day Saints Mormonism is, of the past especially 50 years, the fastest growing religion in the world in terms of percentage. And you speak about, you know, that the Mormonism, by deviating itself, claimed as the, you know, successor to apostolic Christianity, right? And it resolved all of these major theological disputes with this new scripture, this Book of Mormon. Where does that come from? Where does the Book of Mormon come from?
Well, if I could answer that question, I could write a really good book. Yeah, it's really mysterious. I mean, in a sense, I mean, it's a lot's been written on this. It's published in 1830, right? And Joseph Smith publishes it. I mean, there's this whole narrative around it. There's a lot of controversy around it from the beginning. And Joseph Smith describes a revelatory experience at translating the golden plates that were revealed to him. So there's revelation there. I mean, and it's got a fascinating tie in to Christianity, because Christianity is, of course, about revelation. But this promises a new scripture and new scriptures and continuing revelation, whereas traditionally Christians had closed the canon, you know, and it opened the canon back up, and so doing responded to new situations. Also, it talks about an appearance of Jesus Christ in the Americas. So it's just fascinating in terms of where it came from, how it came about, and all of that. A lot of it's kind of shrouded in mystery, as a lot of revelation is. There are just a lot of great books on it, and scholars have dealt with it, and historians have tried to deal with it in various ways. But again, you know, this is one of those ways in which history always has some mystery to it. It's not always so clear exactly what happened when.
Right. Thank you, James. So, Jim, after 1865, the United States experiences massive amounts of immigration before 1924 and then after 1965 from places where immigrants did not originally come from before the Civil War. You know, rising amounts of Eastern European immigrants, East Asian, after 1965, Middle Eastern and African. What religions not only came to the United States through immigration, but what kind of new religions, much like LDS, were formed in this time?
Sure. I think I would probably start by saying the two things that were most new in the late 19th century after the Civil War were an interest in science and new disciplines, electricity, magnetism, photography, and bringing to them old questions like what is a spirit? Is it ectoplasm, which isn't a thing, it's a made up thing? Can we see ghosts? Can I talk to my relatives that I lost in the Civil War? These kinds of questions drive a lot of the new religions, people are interested in healing, but medicine isn't yet so good as to provide all the answers. So Christian Science, seances, and spiritualism are really big in this era. Thought cures, where you can use the power of the mind and concentrate the mind to effect a cure, becomes part of the new religious makeup and creates a whole bunch of groups that continue to this day, mostly small. But once a religious idea is on the plate, it never leaves. Secondly, and relatedly, is an interest in Eastern religions and in the other religion that wasn't here already in large numbers, Islam, and for that matter, Judaism. People become interested in the other world religions. And most of the people throughout American history who want to be Buddhists are native-born Americans, not East Asians. This happens as early as in 1893 with the World Parliament of Religions. It continues down to this day, where a substantial number of American Buddhists are ethnically and by birth Jews. Why is that? It's because in America, you can look over your shoulder and say, I like that part of that religion more than the one my parents raised me in, or I love this text, I'm going to be this. And it's sometimes portrayed as a certain kind of Sheilaism, a cafeteria choice. I believe in me. I don't think it's that so much as some eclectic choices that are available in modernity, with science, with diversity, with having these new neighbors. And I haven't mentioned, you know, the Eastern Orthodox, who really come in quite a few different old world traditions over in this period. So by the early 20th century, America is much more religiously diverse in terms of options, and then in terms of the people who were born into those options. And by the end of the 20th century, say with Orthodoxy again, people who were born into something else and have chosen this old world tradition. So that like half of all Greek Orthodox aren't Greek now. It's their choice of a more traditional liturgical spirituality that makes sense for them.
Yes, I have a Cypriot friend, a very good Cypriot friend, who finds a continual frustration in these non-Greek immigrants. He doesn't come from a provincial sense, but just this, you know, they have a kind of exuberance for Greek Orthodoxy that none of the original ethnically Greek people exhibit. And also with Buddhists as well, I did not meet an Asian Buddhist in the United States until I was in college. It was all white, maybe Latino or Black, you know, kind of people who read your D.T. Suzuki's or Alan Watts, who himself was an Episcopal priest. So a penultimate question as we approach the hour before we conclude is the role of women, another important but frequently marginalized group. James, who are some of the major female participants in the story of American religion before the Civil War?
Yeah, I mean, so women are most prominent in American religious history if we want to count adherents, people who are actually in the pews, actually in the churches. Women have almost always dominated. Women, though, have almost always been neglected in leadership positions. So women aren't the ones, because of the patriarchal culture that existed and the misogynistic presumptions of society, haven't been the ones doing a lot of the writing. So haven't left a lot of the evidence that historians tend to rely on in terms of written records. So part of what we do as historians is we try to bring out that prominent role of women as much as we can. And we do that with various women in the text. I mean, Phoebe Palmer is huge as a Methodist influence. Phoebe Palmer, who basically took an understanding of sanctification that had been inherited from Wesley and then recrafted through Finney and some others, and totally turned it on its head, set it in a new frame, changed the understanding of it in a way that really contributed very much to holiness movements and then the Pentecostal movement. We can see the handprints of Phoebe Palmer all over that understanding of sanctification in what she called the altar theology. Jerina Lee was a preacher in an African-American preacher in the early 19th century who traveled extensively as a Methodist and published her story that focuses specifically on the call to preaching. What does it mean to be called? And what is that vocational discernment? How does that look in a spiritual context, as she brought it out? Jerina Lee, very influential, very important to consider. You know, various other women across time, and people talk about, you know, Anne Hutchinson and the antinomian movement and New England Puritanism as being important. There are various others too. Frances Willard, I mean, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. I don't really know of any movement that was more both culturally, politically, and religiously important than the Women's Christian Temperance movement, both for the buildup of obviously temperance and suffrage you know, it's kind of set in motion those patterns. So yeah, it's one of the key themes of the story, because women did, as Anne Browdy published in a very important article several years ago, women's history is American religious history.
So Jim, how have women asserted themselves in American religiosity after the Civil War? You mentioned spiritualism, theosophy, Christian Science, which were all female led, but in traditional Christian and non-Christian denominations, how did women assert themselves?
So as I think about it, I think the, the long shadow of misogyny, and you know, what can girls do, is been a continuing theme, but with the late 19th and down to the 21st century, the new ecclesiastical forms that we talked about earlier, particularly Pentecostalism and congregationally driven pieties, and even entrepreneurial kinds of leadership, have given us really significant leaders. Amy Simple McPherson, you know, who takes over the radio waves and broadcasts on a different channel every week until J. Edgar Hoover says, you know, the people will be able to find you if you just stick to one channel. Amazing Pentecostal leader. Catherine Kuhlman, a traveling evangelist and healer, big 60s and 70s and beyond. Somebody more entrepreneurial like Gwen Shamblin Lara, with, you know, a diet down kind of a ministry that combines non-Trinitarian theology with Pentecostal practice in an old-fashioned looking church that, you know, could have been plucked right out of, 18th century Charleston in terms of its looks, and then branches out to 300 different locations. All of those are women-led kinds of things, and they didn't ask permission from a traditional denomination. Although the traditional denominations did produce a lot of popular folks. So one thinks of coming out of the Presbyterians and then going, you know, being everybody's favorite lay theologian, Rachel Held Evans, in the 21st century, is the kind of person who just by blogging in the 21st century can say that can provide a reading of religion that people will quickly start clipping and forwarding to each other.
And or the greatest, the greatest.
There are a bunch of those folks right now who, again, are speaking kind of on their own authority on the reading of scripture about life and church and scripture and whatever else.
I was about to say, I was thinking probably the most preeminent novelist in the United States is Marian Robinson.
I was going to mention
who is yeah. Probably, you know, and probably more theologically adept than a lot of people who come out of PhD programs. Although she does have a PhD from University of Washington, but not in theology. Another figure that I was thinking of, which would have been, I think, unheard of 50 years ago, was Paula White, who was one of Donald Trump's main spiritual advisors during his presidency. Yeah. Well, this has been a fantastic discussion. I think we have covered all of the ground but there's so much more in this erudite and detailed bottom-up approach, text that I recommend all read. One, I think, last, and you can answer this as quickly as you'd like. One, I think, question that's been on my mind recently is, even though this text has an appropriate bottom-up social history focus, presidents, as has been mentioned, are important communicators of religious ideas in the United States. And we've spoken a lot about the contrast between theologically educated and more spiritually popularly educated. And James and Jim, you can answer this as quickly as you like. Who is the most theologically adept, theologically sophisticated president, United States president that we've had?
I'm going to go with Abraham Lincoln on this one.
Mm-hmm.
That Lincoln, and I'm writing a book right now on the Lincoln assassination, so I've been reading a lot more about Lincoln. Lincoln, like other presidents, knew his audience in a sense, and he was very biblically articulate, knew a lot about the Bible, and knew a lot about theological ideas. He was very in tune with ideas like providence, and yet he never joined a church. His statements, especially in public speeches like the second inaugural address, have been considered religious classics because he refused to say that God is on my side. He was always the one who said we need to be on God's side in this thing. He also was very theologically astute in talking about slavery and the sin of slavery and its repercussions. Interestingly enough, Mark Knoll, when he wrote his Theology in America book, it was called America's God, from Jonathan Edwards to Abraham Lincoln. So he ended up with Abraham Lincoln because of what he saw as his theological wisdom there.
Professor Byrd is right about Lincoln. I will not argue that point, but let me give you a couple of others from the Democratic Party that may be a surprise. The first may not be. Barack Obama, by channeling Lincoln and Reinhold Niebuhr, said some fairly profound things for a president, and organized his life accordingly, in terms of even some things that he had the power to do but didn't do because he thought it would be wrong, going into Syria, for example. But here's the real dark horse. It's FDR. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a pretty spiritual guy in a kind of old-fashioned New England boys' school kind of piety. He'd learned from his headmaster how to think about life. His dad died young. He was a standard but devout Episcopalian all his life. And the thing that I would point out is he wrote this beautiful prayer all by himself to be read on the ships of the D-Day invasion. And every captain or every commander of any one of these vessels read it over the loudspeaker. And I would challenge your readers to hearers of this podcast to go find that and not to be impressed by the decent piety of a guy who by that point was quite infirm. And had been in power for a long time. There's no cynicism in it.
Thank you both for your answers. I think with me, it has to be Thomas Jefferson, right? And we may consider his writings to be philosophical, but it's all about God, right? And I think he wrote the most about but I appreciate, yes, Lincoln, his second inaugural, and then FDR, who famously, when it was asked what his political beliefs were, he said, "I'm a Christian, a Democrat, and that is all." And so I appreciate that answer as well. Well, just quickly, before we end this, first you, James, and then Jim, what are some future projects you're working on or have been published already?
Okay, I'm a one-at-a-time kind of person. So right now I'm writing a book, trying to finish up a manuscript for Oxford University Press that is basically a religious history of the Lincoln assassination, ways in which religious leaders, religious communities dealt with the assassination, the trauma, how religion played a role in dealing with it, and how it led to this idea of Lincoln as this civil religious character that has been much appreciated in history. And like as Jim points out, Barack Obama picked up on and others have as well.
I'm writing about what I call the moral crisis in American Christianity, a contemporary problem in which every group seems to not want to speak as Christians, but speak politically or in terms of other people's morality. And it's a kind of eclipse of what is best about these respective traditions, be they Catholic, Evangelical, Protestant, Pentecostal, Black Church. We're in a bit of a problem in terms of the authority by which religious people seek to interact with others and even inside their own communities.
Well, both of those works sound fascinating. I cannot wait to read them. Thank you both, James Byrd and Jim Hudnut Boimler, for being on this podcast. Your contributions have been extremely interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you have been listening to New Books in Religion, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jackson Reinhardt. We've been discussing the story of religion in America, an introduction published by Westminster John Knox Press, 2021. Thank you so much for listening.